Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women. This is Stephanie Benson and Nancy Holmes interviewing Mrs. Pauline Kramerman on the morning of March 18, 1976. Mrs. Kramerman, would you tell us something about your family? Start with your grandparents, if you can.
My grandparents on my mother's side came from Lithuania right after the Civil War. They were fur traders, and they used to get their furs from Russia, and then took them to Sweden, where they were sent around the world. My grandfather was a messenger that went to Sweden, and by that time, in those days, it was horse and donkey. I don't know where it was in that particular section of the country. Lithuania at that time was called Russia. You know, there's Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Right below them is Poland. I don't expect you girls to know your European history. My grandmother followed my grandfather a year later, and they settled in the Pocono, right in near the Pocono Mountains, in the town of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. That's a hard, cold section. You know, when we talk about birth control, do you? Babies came one right after another. So my grandparents moved outside of the town where they had a little farm, perhaps 5 acres, so that my grandmother could have a little cow, chickens, and at that time everybody had horses. Coal was discovered by the Lehigh Coal Company, of which Mr. Sprang, the man who's now doing it, his grandfather, and my grandfather's property dealing with coal. So they started the Lehigh Coal Company. He built the company houses, which were houses with a pump and a chick sail. You know what I mean by that, an outboard. So, the first miners who came were Welsh miners, then the Irish miners, and later there was a very big immigration in this country of the Slavonic miners. That's people from Russia and the EU, the Slavonic countries.
What was your grandparents' name?
Salzburg, S-A-L-S-B-Y-G. Do you want my grandmother to know your name?
If you, yes, we would like
that. As you grow older, and I'm only 82, you haven't followed the page
That's
yet.
Right. Did they ever tell you why they decided to come to the United States?
Oh, yes. They came because it was a very big Swedish exodus at that time, and gold was on the street. There had been a Wyoming massacre of Indians right up in that valley. You know where Wilkes-Barre is? That's where they had the big flood. I guess they've had 2 floods up there. And when my grandfather first came to this country, he did what every immigrant did. He was a peddler. And as he went through that section, those beautiful mountains attracted him. When my grandmother came, she landed in New York. I think there were a couple of children. And he took her back there because it was a beautiful country, and he knew he could open a small store. He became quite wealthy in his day. Not a millionaire, but in those days, $500,000 was a lot of money.
How many children were there?
There were 8 or 9. There must have been a couple who died. My mother never, if she was first one born in this country, my mother didn't speak English until she went to grade school. And in those days, the school was a one-room school. If you know anything about education, you know. She did not have an accent, as it happened. But when she was ready to go to the higher school, they sent her to an academy, Kingston Academy or something like that. It later became a college. Mm-hmm. After she got through that, my grandfather's store had become much larger. His business was much bigger, and she went into the business working for him. I'll come to the name if I get my grandmother's maiden name. Will come to me in time.
Well, can you give us your mother's name?
Her name was really Frida, but because she was such a tomboy, they called her Ray. And that's the name that's on her tombstone.
This is your mother's family. What about your father's family?
My father was born also in Lithuania. He was born in Lithuania. And he came to this country. He came to England right after his bar mitzvah. His mother was by that time a widow. He went to an uncle. He was a rabbi in South Wales. And he lived in England. I think it was a man there was Robert Tidway. I couldn't spell it for you. Sorry. And he lived in England until he was about 22 years of age. He lived with the Marxes there. And the Bloom family was there. Mrs. Marx's maiden name was Bloom. And he got his education by going to their trade schools that they had in England that time. It was an evening, late afternoon and evening school. And then he joined a reading guild. And he was very, very well read. I mean, he had a better education than his children had because he was a very hardy student. He came to this country when he was about 22 years of age to visit an uncle who lived in Syracuse, New York. And they took him to Wilkes-Barre, where mutual cousins of both my mother and father lived, although my parents were not related, if you understand that connection. That was the connections. At that time, my grandfather was the president of the Jewish synagogue in that community, and now they're living down in Wilkes-Barre. See, they made their money up in the Foley area. In the meantime, a bus line formed between Wilkes-Barre and Syracuse. That later became the Greyhound bus. They all put money in it. And as money changed, they became more and more secure. So they moved to Wilkes-Barre. Among our people, the Orthodox Jews, and that's what my grandparents were, they call a newcomer up to the pulpit, they call it a bimah. And they have him read from the Torah. That's supposed to be a very big honor. My grandfather on my father's side was a rabbi, so my father had the typical Hebrew training from the time he was about 3 years old that the Rabbonim children get. So my father read in his nice English accent when he translated it. And my mother wanted to know who he was. So she asked her mother, who asked to meet your cousin, and she told him he was Gittel Rupel's son. That's Gladys Roof's son. And that meant my grandparents knew the family. Among our people, family was very, in those days, family was most important. You brought your children together to meet certain types of people. It wasn't snobbish, it was character that was most important. A year later, my parents were married, and my grandfather, Saul Salzberg, put my father in business in Dushore, Pennsylvania. that's on your way up to the pilgrimage mountains. Up to that time, my father was also a pilgrim. He had got to the stage where he had a wagon and a horse. My maternal grandfather, when he pedaled, he started out with a sack on his horses, on his horse. My grandfather was very, very interesting because he knew about the Mullen McGuire's, and he knew about how they managed. They'd go from one town to another and leave their horse and rent another horse to go on with a fresh horse to see. They ate their dinners in the saloons because that's where the dining room was. And my grandfather was very, very tall, and someone called him a Jew, and someone called him something else. So my grandfather got up and ate it, and there was a fight in the saloon. The word gets around, you let David Salisbury alone because he won the fight. He was tall like a Cossack. He was very, very strong. My father wasn't that tall. But I mean, our childhood was filled with these stories of family and stories of activity. Well, from Dushore, my brother was born in Dushore. And from Dushore, in a couple of years, they moved to Pottstown, Pennsylvania. And from Pottstown, they moved to, I guess it was Philadelphia. And from Philadelphia to Uniontown, and then Uniontown to Pittsburgh. Each time it was a larger store. At no time was it a fairly big store, but it was always some sort of a store.
Now, what does your father do?
My father, he was a storekeeper.
All right, can you be more specific?
Well,
was it a general store?
It was started out as a general store, and then it became a main store, and finally it was a chain of stores, much like Auckland, which even at Auckland it's easier. Mm-hmm. It was called Canyon Inn and Stores. And later, he had a heart attack when he was about 60. That meant he had quit being a businessman, and he sold people insurance. By that time, both my brother, well, my sister was also in college. The three children were college. My brother was an architect. He was
okay.
An architect.
Now, your brother was older than you, you said.
Yes.
And you were in the middle?
I'm in the middle, yeah.
Could you get us their names?
Yes, Alfred.
And he's an architect.
He's gone. He was an architectural engineer. On Norwood Gardens is one of it was Norwood Gardens. It's now part of Carnegie Tech. It's one of his buildings. The Home for the Aged is another one of his buildings. Several temples around. And there were several housing projects around at the end of his term. Now, I'm the little child, and I went to college. Do you want to name that college?
Yes, I would.
All right, I'm ready. 1917. Yeah. And then I did 2 years more work.
After you graduated?
After I graduated at Lovely Anna Thompson. That's part of the Minnesota minor. And that is how I got into medical school.
Okay. Now, just what do you mean that is how you got into
medical school? Well, at that time, it was almost impossible for a woman to get into medical school, but having done 2 years war work, the VA president of my college saw that I got into medical school. Mm-hmm. He was a Ben Briggs from Harvard University.
Had you wanted to go for some time?
No. It was work that I did during World War I.
Describe that.
We made
anatoxins.
Uh-huh. And the anatoxin was made by immunizing first horses and then bleeding them. And the final step was bleeding them to death. Mm-hmm. And then the blood came to the laboratory where I later gradually worked up to being the foreman of that laboratory. and we refine and filter the blood.
And so then you went to medical school. Where?
Right, University of Pittsburgh.
I'm very interested in hearing something of some of your reflections on that, because it must have been very difficult being a woman and a Jew at that time during medical school.
Well, I didn't come in for the interview because after the war was over, we had an army in Germany, and we also had an army in Italy. And Italy had a hog cholera epidemic. And luckily, it would not release me because we were making a cholera vaccine and for immunizing serum to immunize the hogs in Italy. And that was part of the food that our boys were getting in World War I. And I went back to Cambridge and called on Dr. President Briggs and told him what I had done and that I felt I was entitled to go to medical school and they wouldn't release me. And he says that we go back and stay until next fall. See, the interviews were in the spring before.
Before entrance.
Yes, before entrance. And he said, you go back, and I'll take care of you and give you. So I didn't come here. Now, he must have known some important doctors on the faculty and on the board at the university. And
he must have felt very positively about you, too.
Well, he had ample opportunity to know me. While I was in college, I worked as a babysitter for his wife's aunt, who was an invalid in their home. And quite often, Mrs. Briggs would call me and ask me to step in and take some money to the bank or go here and there. And many times, I was at their table to eat. So, Fred and Briggs knew me very, very well.
Were there any other women in your medical school class?
Yes, there were two other women, Dr. Jean Foy and Dr. Elizabeth Jones. Dr. Jean Foy got into medical school by being a nurse at one of our student mills. I think it was Jones and Lockburn. She was in the emergency department. And it was one of the men there who got her into medical school. And I can't tell you what Dr. Childs' contact was. But you had to have four to get into medical school.
You mean, okay, as a woman?
As a woman, not as a man. Maybe as a man, I don't know. But you had to have four.
What was your reception as far as the other...
For the medical school?
Yes.
Well, I was a very proud youngster. Here, I had done war work. I was graduate. I came from what I considered a refined Jewish family. I was not ashamed of anything, and when people got rough with me, they got my elbows. And when I say that, I mean I would answer them in no short order. I wasn't interested in any of the men in my school, so if a man was a little bit nasty with me, I'd use his kind of language and tell him to shut up with them. I took nothing. I didn't have to. While I was in medical school, I was picked up as a laboratory technician, and that's because there was a shortage of technically trained people. Have you had chemistry?
Oh, way back.
All right, well, you have to know how to clean chemical material, and it's a little bit different than washing it for second water. And I would have been through that stage of technical training, both in college and in law work. So they picked me up first in chemistry and then in physiology. My medical education cost my family nothing. Because
what
I
do you mean they picked you up?
They found out that I had been a chemical technician. Mm-hmm. You see, and I had this training. So Dr. McElroy needed a technician.
I see. So
a teacher's assistant, I think we call him now. So, and then Dr. Guthrie took me on for physiology.
Okay.
And they gave me my tuition and they gave me a stipend.
Now, Now, did you specialize, or what did you decide to specialize in?
I didn't decide to specialize. I wanted to get out and work with people.
So
I opened an office in Homewood on Homewood Avenue and went into general office. The neighborhood that I settled in was great deal Italian. And they were first generation Italians, plus their American children. Mama wanted a midwife and Papa wanted a doctor, and I was a combination of both. Do you follow what I'm trying
to
say? And after at that time, I worked at the West Penn Hospital in the pediatric department, thinking I wanted to be, I got interested in children, and thinking I wanted to be a pediatrician. But when I began to take stock of myself, this is after 10 years, I realized that what was coming up my steps was women with their troubles and not children. So I got an appointment with my appointment in gynecology.
Oh, I see. That was 10 years, you said, after. Are you still practicing medicine at all? Up to what time did you?
Well, I guess it's about 1 year. But the telephone is still ringing, and they're mostly old women who have to wait 4 to 6 weeks to get an appointment somewhere or don't know where to go. And I'll tell them I don't have an office or I'm working for the state or I'm doing something. And they come anyhow.
To your home, you mean?
To my home. And then if they really are in trouble, like a hard-boiled, a stiff abdomen or a lump somewhere, and I'll call one of the men. You're leaving. All right. Goodbye. And I'll call one of the boys that I know. I know all the younger men because they're very few my age in either hospital, West Penn or Montefiore. And I'll say, I have an emergency. And they'll put them in. And sometimes a patient will be into the hospital that night. And sometimes she has to wait till the next day. Now that, I should say, is a service. Sometimes they lay down money, sometimes they send me a present, and sometimes they say thank you.
Most of your work then, after the first 10 years of practice, was as an OBGYN?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There's a very good article in this month's Pennsylvania Magazine on the role of the family doctor. He became a psychosomatic doctor. He helped, he was their listening board. He helped them in solving their problems. He knew their family. You now go into a doctor's office and you're called by a nurse. The doctor meets you after you're undressed. He takes care of his square inch that he's supposed to, and you as an individual count as nothing. And I started to practice. Each family was a unit, and you knew them.
And you saw this change you're talking about taking place over the course of your career.
Yes, but they're now training men for family physicians because a great many people are going to psychiatrists when it really isn't necessary. It's just a temporary thing that works itself out. Or if Mama had someone to talk to, she wouldn't be so apt to leave Papa.
I want you to talk, I don't quite know how to phrase this question, but I want you to talk more about practicing medicine in Pittsburgh. Can you over the course of your career?
Well, when I first started, I started out as a family doctor.
Uh-huh.
And the call I got was because the other family doctor was out. The police or some neighbor says, well, I know a woman. I don't know how good she is. Maybe she'll come. And I went into the home. The child was having a convulsion, as many children do right before measles. Off went my dress, and out came I in the tube, and out came the package of mustard. And Mama held the baby or the child with a wet cold but top over its forehead, and we gave it a high enema, and we brought the child out of the convulsion. Public health nurses now, if you need that.
Did you find much resentment about the fact that you were a woman?
At first, the druggist at the corner said she won't last 6 months.
You're such an anomaly.
Yes, but after these Italians had had me in, or even the Scotch-Irish that were in the neighborhood and they had me in, the men would talk in the pool room or in the drugstore and say, well, I don't care what you say about that Jew. She's a woman, but she isn't afraid to work. You see, they were very, I mean, people, I never heard the word Jew until I became a practicing physician. You see, at Smith College, you'd have to know Radcliffe as it was in those days. In my class, there were only about 100 girls. You made your associations. I was interested in music. I was interested in what was going on in World War I that started. And your interests and your classes made your friends. You were accepted and encouraged. So, and all kinds of tickets came in from Boston people. That is for the symphony or for the opera or anything. And someone would say, I have 2 tickets. Well, who wants to go with me? You see, and I had a very fine social life, and I majored in biology, and I did cross-country hiking on the weekends.
Thank you. Okay. Continuing.